sales win rates have plummeted to a mere 17%, and outdated technology and tedious manual processes are to blame. Meanwhile, managers lack the visibility they need to hold their teams accountable. But imagine a world in which these crippling issues are solved automatically. Revenue.io automates the most frustrating parts of sales so reps can focus on what they do best, selling. Completely automate pre-call research, logging conversation data in your CRM, writing post-conversation recap emails, and prioritized outreach. And as reps book more meetings and close more deals, managers gain the real-time insight they need to scale what's working across their entire team. Ready to say goodbye to tedious sales processes and watch your win rate soar? Head over to revenue.io to learn more.
The average American car buyer now spends about 12 hours researching the purchase. They go to Edmunds.com, Autotrader.com. They find out the wholesale price that the dealer is getting. And they only spend a total of about 3.5 hours in dealerships themselves. Yet, about 98.6% of cars are still bought through dealers, not online. Now, does this mean that the internet and that information is irrelevant? Does it mean that it's destroying dealerships? It doesn't mean it's destroying dealerships, but it clearly has changed buying. People walk into a dealer already having product and price information.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Sales Enablement Podcast. I'm your host, Andy Paul. That was Frank Cespedes, and Frank's a senior lecturer at Harvard Business School and the author of an excellent new book titled Sales Management That Works, How to Sell in a World That Never Stops Changing. And change, you know, is a constant subject of conversation in the sales ecosystem, but what are these changes? Well, in our conversation, Frank and I are going to talk about some of these changes are, including some that are hugely important to buyers, but not terribly visible to sellers, or perhaps that sellers are so entrenched in their old ways of thinking that they're blind to some important changes that are impacting how they should be selling. So as Frank and I dig into these, he sounds a cautionary note that we explore, which is that the conventional wisdom, meaning everything you read online and so on, about these changes is actually misleading. And so we explore that. We dive into one of my favorite topics, sales productivity. I love talking about the subject with someone with a more academic grounding. And the question is, are salespeople today, who are the beneficiaries of tremendous technological advantages, are they able to be more productive than sellers in previous generations? Interesting answer, you'll hear to that. And we explore another topic that I'm passionate about as well, and this increasing disconnect from the processes the buyer goes through to make a purchase decision versus our selling processes. You know, these should be in really tight alignment, but that's not the case. And Frank makes his own case about why the sales funnel is dead. And he shares what you need to know about the buying process today and how that affects how you should be selling. So you don't want to miss this. And we get into all that and much, much more. But before we get to Frank, I want to remind you to subscribe to this podcast wherever you listen to it. And if you subscribe, we'd always appreciate it if you could also give us your feedback about how we're doing in the form of a review. So thank you. All right, let's jump into it. Frank, welcome back to the show.
Andy, very, very good to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me back.
Well, glad it's been way too long. We shouldn't wait till we have a new book come out.
Well, yes, that's true. On the other hand, we can do this two or three times about the new book. It's all
that's
right
true.
With you.
Well, I think we will do that because there's so much to cover. It's such a good book called Sales Management That Works. And the theme of the book is really starts with change. And I think that this is certainly an appropriate topic for sales, which is all about change. But you say that sales is changing. But before we get into the details of that, as I have sort of a broader question, a framing question for you. And this is, in your opinion, because I haven't seen any data on this, is are sellers today more or less productive than sellers in previous decades? Meaning, and I, Yeah, I sort of use this measure of dollars of revenue generated per hour of selling time as sort of a metric. But you know, my sense is, and I ask this question a lot, is even despite sort of being in this quote unquote golden age of sales technology and marketing technology, there's a sense that sellers are less productive today than they were before. And I was wondering if you had a sense about that.
And I can also cite some data, but it's, you know, now I'm putting my academic hat on for a second over my bald head, Andy. But let me just say it's circumstantial evidence, but it all tends in the direction that supports your point of view. You know, look, selling is obviously a very, very diverse activity. Selling software is different than selling capital goods. Selling enterprise software is different than selling SaaS, et cetera. But this is what the data says if you erase all of that heterogeneity.
Right.
First, there is the anecdotal data that you get again and again across industries about the dwindling percentage of reps that make quota. All right.
Correct.
So that's number one. Number two is, I think, a bit more interesting data. But if you look at the cost structures of the Fortune 1000 companies globally over the last 15 years, the reality is that those companies, out of necessity, the financial crisis in 2008, 2009, now the pandemic, but those companies have actually done a very, very good job managing their costs and their productivity for what you might call back office functions, you know, shared services, et cetera. On the other hand, SG&A, and especially the S part, the selling part,
right,
that has increased dramatically as a percentage of companies' total costs. And then the third thing is the data about what percentage of time salespeople actually spend in customer contact. And by customer contact, I don't just mean, you know, showing up at someone's office or doing it via Zoom. I mean all customer contact through phone, emails, et cetera. And in most sales forces, that number is about 30 to 35%. In other words, you know, 70 plus percent of the time is not spent doing what a salesperson's hired to do. Again, that all of those items are going to change and differ fairly significantly across company and industry. But in the aggregate, there's a lot of circumstantial evidence to support your instincts about this.
Yeah, and it was further triggered by an article I'd seen that Paul Krugman had published in the New York Times last fall, talking about rate of productivity growth in the U.S. economy and saying it's, you know, basically flat in the 2000s, this century. And but when you looked at his chart, sort of the inference of productivity growth really since, I guess it was the 70s, is that productivity growth basically was driven by personal computer, email, and the internet, and broadband. And beyond that, things, it's like we've sort of milked the productivity gains out of those, and now we're sort of flat. And so all this technology we're adding to on top of sales isn't making a difference.
Well, you know, that's actually, I discussed that actually in the last chapter of the book that we're talking about here. And first, Krugman's right about the basic facts. And most economists, I think, know this, and that is that there has been a flattening and indeed a decline in productivity, not only in the United States, but in most other industrialized countries for the last 20 to 30 years. What is more of a mystery, however, is why that's the case. And the best evidence about this points, I think, to two factors. And one of them is definitely going to be relevant to sales. But the two main factors here seem to be, first, demographics, declining birth rates. And then the second one is the shift in most industrialized economies over the last half century from manufacturing to predominantly services-dominated economies. The U.S. is a good example of that.
Sure.
This is why the pandemic has been such a catastrophe. About 75% of our GDP is in service businesses. Now, Peter Drucker, you know, the great Peter Drucker, I mentioned Peter Drucker to my MBA students last semester, and it was like I mentioned Julius Caesar. You know, you don't go into business to be famous, but, you know, Peter Drucker was one smart guy.
Absolutely.
And he wrote an article 30 years ago. 30 years ago, he wrote an article in Harvard Business Review about the crisis of services productivity. And he pointed to sales and salespeople as a good example. And 30 years ago, Peter Drucker said what you said. He said, look at how much time salespeople spend essentially with computers. And he said, that's not productivity. That kills productivity. And Drucker said that if these societies don't deal with this productivity, services productivity issue, we can expect political problems and class warfare. Sounds pretty prophetic to
me. It does, doesn't it? Yeah.
It's a big issue. And in fact, it's one of the reasons why in the book, I basically emphasize that this book about sales is not simply about increasing shareholder value, although it is. And I don't think companies should apologize for that. But it is also a social responsibility of management because it affects economic growth, opportunity, and the way societies operate.
Yeah, I mean, you and I were sort of touching this a little bit before we started recording, which we probably should have recorded that part. But it's I think you see this, and you talk about this in the book, with the high turnover rates in sales. I think you cite, 20 to 30% per year, is, people are searching for something, right? Something better. And I don't think it's driven by, trying to find a company with better product market fit or something like that. I'm sure in some cases it is, but I think it's like they have vision of what sales is supposed to be like, and they're trying to find that.
Yeah. And I think I think there are, one of the reasons for that, again, it's one of the themes in the book, but it's really for me, I had two major motivations in writing this book. And the first one is directly relevant to what you're saying, Andy. And it's something that sort of puzzled and bothered me throughout my career. Of all the various functions in business, sourcing, production, operations, et cetera, sales and selling are by far the most context specific. Mm-hmm. Right? Selling in North America is different than selling in Asia, different than selling in the Middle East, et cetera, et cetera. Yet, of all the business functions, for some reason, sales is that area where many people, including business people, feel comfortable making these huge a priori generalizations that, in my opinion, are not only vacuous and not supported by the data, but also generate the stereotypical assumptions that you're pointing to. And I think that is one of the reasons that we see that poor ROI in training. And then I think there are other reasons that are simply built in to this function. There are inherent challenges in hiring, training, and developing salespeople.
Yeah, and we're definitely going to get into those because I think that's, it's some of the most popular or most engaged posts that I post these days, which get huge engagement around hiring. And yeah, I mean, it definitely could be done better. So I do want to get into that. Another point I wanted to ask, though, is because you come from a more academic perspective on this whole issue, and you talk about this idea you just mentioned, the conventional wisdom about the impact of these changes on sales is misleading. Isn't that sort of an issue, though? You say it's context specific, but isn't that one of the really issues with sales? Is there is no, good data? I mean, rigorous data. It seems like so much of the research we see about sales is, self-reported results. I mean, we don't really have like the equivalent of like a rigorous double-blind study that you might see in a pharmaceutical clinical trial to measure the effectiveness of anything in sales.
Well, I mean, first of all, what you just said is true of a lot of other areas of business. I mean, you know, this is one of the reasons why a lot of business people, I think, quite legitimately have reservations about, you know, Professor X or Theorist Y. When you're doing research and gathering data in business, that's qualitatively different than doing research, you know, for some peer-reviewed, statistically significant paper in a journal, or doing double-blind research to make sure the vaccine works in a clinical trial. What you're doing in business is you have to do that research, interpret it, and make changes while the boat is under full sail in an ocean where you do not control the weather.
Right.
So if, in fact, we evaluate the data, if what we mean by good data is what we mean in a clinical trial, that rarely exists, and not only in sales. But that doesn't mean we don't have data that's useful for decision-making and continuous improvement purposes. You know, it's a little bit like air pollution. You can get rid of 80% of it one way, and then that final 20% costs a heck of a lot.
Right.
So, you know, I don't think absence of data is an excuse not to get better and better at this core business activity. And in fact, I think a lot of talk about so-called big data, I don't know about you, but I've been hearing that all my career, right?
Yeah.
35 years ago, I was hearing about data, big data. It's only gotten bigger. I think for many executives, that's a convenient excuse and naive, because the assumption very often in that talk is that somehow the data will speak for itself. No, it's not. Managers have to manage. What does this data tell us about who is our customer, who isn't? How do we segment? What does that mean for hiring, training, performance reviews, relevant metrics, et cetera? You know, again, I'll quote Peter Drucker. Drucker wrote a great article about 50 years ago called The Manager and the Moron. By the way, Andy, can you still hear me? My computer.
I can hear you.
The moron was the computer, and the manager was the person responsible for asking the right questions of the computer. I think that's still true, even if you've got allegedly self-correcting algorithms, as some people say they have in machine learning.
Right. Well, I think this does bring a critical point about sales, which is that, yeah, we don't know how to use this data, to your point, make good decisions about it, that, you know, people see correlations where correlations don't exist, or cause and effect where cause and effect doesn't exist. And it seems like that is one area where starting with sales managers and sales leadership would be really important to get more instruction, more training to them, so that, yeah, this is a societal issue, right? We're all, not all, but people just aren't trained how to read data, and we draw the wrong conclusions from it.
Yeah, but I think in sales in particular, let me quote something that you and I were talking about before the podcast began. You know, Billy Beane, the general manager of the Oakland Athletics, the godfather of data analytics in sports. Yeah, sabermetrics, etc. Beane always makes, a very fundamental point. And his point is, look, there's always been a lot of data in baseball in particular, you know, going back to 19th century box scores, lots of this data. The issue is not, can you get the data? The issue is, do you have good questions to ask about the data? And I think that's particularly true in sales. For example, with sales managers, I don't think the most important thing for them is to go to a statistics course so they understand the difference between, you know, an R-square of 0.9 and a spurious correlation, although that occasionally helps. The real important thing is, do they understand buying in their target markets? And do they understand what that means for cause and effect links in what it is they're doing when they organize, deploy, and provide incentives for sales? Then the data can help. But if you lack those priors, all you're doing is what a lot of big data people do. You know, with any database of sufficient magnitude, of course you're going to find statistically significant correlations. That's just the math. But most of them are just going to be plain silly.
Yeah. Well, I agree with you 100%. It's all about asking questions. That's really what the point I was trying to make. Learning how to ask questions of the data is, there's a simple little book I had a guest on wrote called Every Data. James Johnson wrote it, or John Johnson, I think, about just how we just are unable to really to interpret data and ask the questions of the data. And since your point is, you know, we're having more and more of that available to sales leadership and sellers themselves, if they don't know how to interrogate it, then can you use it effectively?
Yeah. You know, I was talking to this company will remain nameless. It's out in your neck of the woods. One of the famous high-tech firms, and one of the senior executives there, and his point was a lot of this is, in effect, done for external, call it what you want, public relations, marketing purposes. He said, but look, here's the way it works, Frank. When I am talking to potential investors, I say what we do is artificial intelligence. And when I am talking to my IT people, I tell them your job is to develop the right algorithms. And when I'm talking to my managers, all I ever talk about is correlations. So you know, there's different ways of spinning this.
Yeah. Well, let's jump into the book again. So one thing I really liked is sort of tackling this chasm that exists increasingly between sort of the sales process and the buying process. And so you've laid out this idea of streams as opposed to a funnel. And take us through that.
Well, I mean, you know, the basic point is that while a lot of what we've just finished talking about, you know, the information revolution, think of it that way, the easy availability of data in the 21st century, while a lot of that can impede productivity, there's no doubt that it has affected buying in both B2B and B2C markets. I mean, you know, my favorite example of this, and it sort of illustrates the difference in buying, one of my favorite examples of this is buying a car. Right?
Right.
The vast majority of cars, both before and interestingly during the pandemic, the vast majority of cars are still bought in dealerships. But this is what the J.D. Power data tells you. The average American car buyer now spends about 12 hours researching the purchase. They go to Edmunds.com or Trader.com. Right. They find out the wholesale price that the dealer is getting, the price for each a feature or package, etc. And they only spend a total of about 3.5 hours in dealerships themselves. Yet, 90, you know, your body temperature, about 98.6% of cars are still bought through dealers, not online.
Right.
Now, does this mean that the internet and that information is irrelevant? It doesn't mean that it's destroying dealerships. It doesn't mean it's destroying dealerships, but it clearly has changed buying. People walk into a dealer already having product and price information. And the days of the salesperson there as kind of, you know, slick, walking, talking purveyor of discounts, those days are gone. Buying a car in America is a much nicer experience now than it was 10 years ago, not because these people went to Bible school, but because of what information is done to the buyer. And the same is true in many, many, if not virtually all product categories, because of what you can now get on your cell phone, because of what you can now get in B2B markets through Power Reviews or Marketo, you get all that information. So buyers don't just move through a funnel. They're online and offline in multiple, at multiple points throughout their buying journeys. That's what I mean by the streams. And you are right. Most sales models have yet to catch up with that reality of buying. There is a big gap there.
Yeah, I mean, I guess my thoughts are crystallized when Gartner came out with their buyer enablement study back, I don't know, fall of 18, I think it was. And they show, you know, their famous spaghetti diagram flowchart of the buying process. And it was like, okay, huh. I've never talked to a single company that's tried to mirror their sales process or align their sales process with this process, which at its heart had four jobs the buyers are trying to accomplish, which are very similar to the streams that you define. And it's a messy, recursive process, but it's like, yeah, sales is still thinking, I've got this linear, staged-based process very neatly defined, and this is what the buyer is going through.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you got to have a little empathy. I think there you got to understand why there's that gap, despite the fact that now the technology is increasingly the seller's friend. The technology is increasingly making it easier for the people who know what they want to do in sales to deal with these streams of both simultaneous offline and online buying. Mm-hmm. But there are a couple of reasons for the gap, I think fairly systematic reasons. One is, you know, the short-term orientation in sales. You know, I always quote, at Harvard Business School where I teach, you know, we write case studies. I'm very grateful that I've had to do that throughout my career. I always remember one of the executives in sales that I interviewed for one of the very first cases I wrote. And he, you know, I was asking him questions and I probably smelled like an academic at that point in my career. And he said, now let me tell you something, Frank. In my line of work, you know, because I was talking about the long term, he said, in my line of work, if you don't survive the short term, you don't have to worry about the long term.
Right.
That's why change is always difficult in sales. And by the way, that's why sales is always, always a great place to look at technology adoption, precisely because technology has to demonstrate its existential usefulness in sales in ways that it doesn't have as much pressure to do in other areas. So that's one reason. The other reason, and this one I think is changing, but I have been involved, yeah, I do a fair amount of work with companies around the world.
Sure.
I've probably run as many strategy meetings as anybody, certainly as many as anybody at Harvard Business School. And I can't tell you in the last two decades how many meetings I've been in where we've got what I consider these fairly sterile academic debates about should we be online, should we be offline, you know, should we be selling through salespeople or through the website? And the answer in the 21st century to that question is yes.
Yes, right.
You got to do both. That's a false dichotomy. I think that one's breaking down. I think the pandemic actually has accelerated that breakdown. But then I think there's a third reason, and again, this is something you and I touched briefly on before we started recording, but it, you know, the C-suite, this is a big change that doesn't get enough attention, in my opinion. If you look at the composition of the senior executive groups, the so-called C-suite of companies around the world, there's a wonderful study that was done by a colleague of mine just a few years ago. And what she found is that over the last 25 years, on average, the number of executives reporting to the CEO has doubled, right? Twice mm-hmm. as much. But then if you ask yourself, who are these people? Where did they come from? What did they do before they became senior executives? Very few of them had actually been general managers in the sense in which I think people like you and me use that term. A general manager, you know, someone running a line of business.
Right, a division,
or,
right.
You know, P&L responsibility. Most of them were specialists. The CIO, the CMO, general counsel, head of data analytics, et cetera, et cetera. Now, why is that the case? You know, most Most companies don't wake up in the morning and say, hey, let's be siloed and bureaucratic. The reason is that business has gotten more complex because of the data revolution. It's a full-time job to stay on top of what a CIO or a CMO, et cetera, needs. But the reality is that's the composition of the C-suite in more and more companies, and fewer people than ever before have made it to the C-suite with P&L experience and sales experience in particular. And I think that's another contributing factor to the gap that you're putting your finger on.
But having identified it, and this gap being identified, is, you know, the Gartner study's been out for 2+ years. I'm sure you've been talking about your four streams for a while. Is like, again, I haven't had a single conversation with a sales executive, leader, to say, yeah, this gap is a problem, because I think it informs how they approach the customer, and I think it's a contributor to, you know, sort of some of the trends we talked about in terms of sales performance, sales productivity. Is, yeah, the buyers sort of moved on and sales hasn't.
Well, I mean, you know, what you're asking in some ways is, you know, well, okay, how do we close that gap? Am I tracking? I mean, you know, I think, look, as with any gap, you got to work both sides, all right? The supply and the demand side. I think the key responsibility for sales managers is to make sure they understand how buying happens at their target accounts today, not yesterday, right? Mm-hmm. The most important thing about selling is the buyer and the buying process. And then you ask yourself, this is also what sales managers have to do, what does this imply for the key sales tasks? In other words, what are, given the way buying works, what are the tasks where my people have to be great? And given the buying, where are the tasks where they just have to be good enough? All right. Because like any other manager, they've got to set priorities, they have to make trade-offs, et cetera. That's what they need to do to argue for the right resources so they can do hiring, training, development correctly. Then on the other side, I don't think the answer to the C-suite gap is micromanaging, which I see going on a lot with data. I don't think that a CIO or a COO or even the CEO, their job is not to be the best sales leader in the world. But their job is to understand what is, given the buying in their market, a relevant versus an irrelevant sales model. And then, as Billy Bean said, their job is to know what are the questions to ask.
Right.
So, you know, I think as with any gap, it takes two to tango. And those are the areas where I think people need to pay attention and work harder at.
Yeah, no, I think this gap is, to me, is a huge, is the place where the problem exists. Now, so I just want to go through and identify the four streams you talk about, these sort of parallel activities, parallel streams that buyers going through. You call them explore, evaluate, engage, and experience. And I sort of, you know, summarize them as explore is to identify the problem, evaluate, explore options, engage. Well, I know in the Gartner, that's more of the finalize the requirements stage, but and then experience is the formal buying decision.
Mm-hmm. Yep. No, you've got it right, and your evocation of that Gartner study is exactly right, because I was actually involved with them when they did that study, and really what I've got here is a variation on that, and then the rest of the book is what I call the so what now what questions. What does this mean for core areas in sales management, like who you hire, what you do with them once you hire them, how do you conduct performance reviews, what about pricing, channel management, etc.
Right.
But the whole point of those streams is that they are streams. They're not linear sequential funnels because of technology, but technology is simply an enabler for this.
So one question I have, and I'm interested in your take on this, because you know, when I looked at the Gartner study and you know, reading this part of the book where you describe the streams, it has sort of think about this in the context of my own experience and experiences selling large deals to large enterprises and so on, is that I always felt like it's sort of divided into sort of two, the buying process always sort of divided into two steps. One is we've got a certain amount of motions that we go through to define how we're going to solve a problem. And then having decided how we're going to solve it, we choose who we're going to solve it with. And so I look at, you know, sort of the explore, evaluate, engage stages, streams that you talk about as, yeah, fundamentally, this is, look, we're going to define our problem, define the potential outcomes that we can achieve by solving it. We're going to go out and evaluate options in the market. We're going to winnow that down, as you talked about, to a select number of options. We're going to choose one of those options, which may or may not be vendor specific. And then we're going to choose a vendor, having solved the sort of the how problem, we're going to choose a vendor to help us implement that.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Yeah, no, that's. I think that's a very good summary and analog for what I'm saying about those streams.
Right.
You know, now let's look at the other end. What does this mean for the selling? You know, the way I.
Yeah. That was the point. That was the point I was going to make, is that I think that one of the fundamental problems that exists in sales is we train people to sell to solve the who, and not enough to solve the how.
Yeah, yeah. The way I sort of phrase that, and I think I also think, by the way, there is a lever available in my experience to 99% of sales managers that they don't use appropriately to deal with this. But the distinction I always draw is between the buyer's motivation in that category, that purchasing process, and their perception of you, your company, your product. Mm-hmm. And by and large, it is very difficult to change a buyer's motivation. That's called customer discovery. That's right. What it is we need to understand. But what is more malleable, and this is the art of salesmanship, is the perception of what it is that we do or don't do, the perception of the solution they are trying to solve, how to measure the value outcomes, et cetera. And a big part of that is framing. You know, that's one of the chapters in the book, and that is something one can work on. Now, the other vehicle I think that's relevant here, Andy, and this, you know, gets us back to data and other things, but the way things work, especially with the big deals that, you know, you were using in your experience and in this example, the most important data in situations like that is not aggregate data about an industry or a market. You know, a market has never bought anything. In the history of business, a market has never bought a thing. Only specific accounts buy. So the most important data is usually only available to a sales manager by doing good account reviews with their reps, good performance reviews. And that's vital. When sales managers do what I call drive-by reviews, sloppy right. reviews, they're not only in effect perpetuating a culture of underperformance, they're inhibiting the flow of vital information that no database is going to give them, because right. it's very, very account specific information. So, you know, that's a lever that they need to use. And by the way, and I learned this in the business I ran for 12 years, doing performance reviews, as opposed to, you know, just talking about compensation, that's a very trainable skill. And it's almost always well worth the investment.
Right. So let me ask another question about that is so, because one of the things you talk about is understanding where the customer is in their process is central to effective selling. And I think that was a quote from it. And isn't that to me, one of the real issues with this gap that exists is that sales manager, they're doing their reviews and they're saying, well, where's the customer stand in their stand? And the seller tries to answer by saying, well, we're at the discovery stage or the qualification stage, which has no relevance at all to what the buyer is actually going through.
Well, I mean, it may or may not have relevance, but it's, you know, sort of it's sort of a random walk, as they say on Wall Street. And by the way, I think, again, you got to ask yourself, why is this so prevalent? Why do you see it? Why do I see it? If you look at CRM software, most CRM software is built on that sequential, linear, you know, funnel, all the pipeline stuff that you hear about in 90% of sales blogs. And what the software does is weight the probability of a sale depending on where in that funnel, that set of funnel categories, the buyer is. But that's not the way people buy now for the most part. That's not what the Gartner study or what I call explore, evaluate, et cetera, is about. So you've got a disconnect there as well in the data that not only sales managers are often looking at, but what their bosses are looking at.
Yeah, all connected, right?
Yeah.
Well, I wanted to jump into talent and hiring because, again, it's I mentioned, I think maybe when we were talking before the we'd start recording, it's just this seems to be a topic that people are continually sort of struggling with. And I know it's something that's hard to perfect, but it seems to me like the processes we use to hire salespeople that I've seen maybe one company in my experience that you know, actually I had a system that sort of said, well, yeah, we're going to track data about the people we hire and then use that to educate ourselves about how to make better decisions with candidates in the future. And you describe a process that in general is fairly random in the way people hire.
Yeah. I mean, I think, just two things about this topic, which is you're exactly right. It's a big topic. It all begins with people, especially in sales. Buying and selling have always been social as well as economic transactions. And for the most part, you don't create a relationship with your computer, you know, unless you're different. Let's put it that way.
Yes.
But first, there are inherent challenges in sales hiring that really don't exist in some other areas. You know, if you want to hire an engineer, you can go to an engineering school and it's like a buffet. What are you looking for? Electrical engineering, chemical engineering. If you want to hire an accountant or finance person, there are people that majored in those subjects. The same is true for programmers. But that's not true in sales. Very, very few schools have a sales course,
right,
let alone a sales program. So the vast, vast majority of people who go into sales go in almost totally unprepared, right? So
yes,
that increases the difficulties of hiring. Then you get to the processes. And what I'm about, the research I am about to cite is as close to an established fact as anything you will ever hear in a management school. It's supported by now about almost 70 years of studies that consistently show the same results. The correlation between the evaluations that people get in their interviews and their subsequent, you know, on-the-job performance in most businesses is significantly less than 0.5. In other words, significantly less than flipping a coin.
Yep.
And in fact, in service businesses, because that's a very people-intensive set of tasks, the correlation is around 0.2. Now, the interesting thing is that when I show this research to executives, their response is a classic example of the, you know, the Kubler-Ross stages of grief, right? First, there's denial. Oh, that's
right.
BS. You know, look, 70 years of research. I literally show them, you know, the reviews. Then it's sort of anger. Then it's what they call exceptionalism. In other words, this is probably true of you and that person.
You do it differently.
I somehow I know how to peer into people's souls. I have many colleagues who basically, on the basis of these facts about interviewing, say companies should abolish interviews. You know, in my opinion, only someone who's never managed a business can say that. Of course you interview.
Right.
I mean, people have to work with people. People have to manage people, right, especially in sales. But you have to augment those interviews with other processes. And sales is fundamentally a performance art. Sales is about behavior. It's not about how well they interview. And what you need to do, and by the way, this is much more possible than many managers think it is. Whenever possible, you want to put in place, you know, some kind of process where you get a chance to actually observe behavior. It might be a 3 to 6 month trial period.
Sure.
It might be something.
I love that idea.
Yeah. But, you know, those, I think, are the big issues around sales hiring. And I think, again, the pandemic has thrown a lot of this into relief. A lot of companies during the pandemic, out of necessity, you know, essentially went back and said, all right, we got to make choices about who's a keeper and who's not. If, in fact, the recovery, and I hope I'm wrong about the recovery, I think it's going to be tougher than what we're hearing. But if, in fact, we have a so-called V-shaped recovery, mm-hmm, these hiring and talent issues, especially in business development functions, they're going to be paramount. The issue is not going to be technology. The issue is not going to be, hey, how do you run the Zoom meeting? The issue is going to be the people. So, you know, companies need to get better at this.
Well, yeah. I mean, you have a statistic you cite in the book that 50% of U.S. college grads will work in sales at some point, maybe where they have business development responsibility. And that's not even including, you know, the 75% of or so of white-collar workers that Dan Pink identified as having responsibility for influence to get their job done. That's a lot of folks if there's a V-shaped recovery being put into what you talk about as these sort of unstructured interviewing processes where, you know, first impressions are so important. And yeah, I love the Moneyball example you gave where the scouts, you know, would rank players higher because they were handsome. And I've seen that. Yeah, I've had a client that hired someone because he looked good in a suit. So, I mean, what can I say?
Yeah, but, you know, notice what's embedded, though, in that data. You know, you've got very, very few people who have even taken a sales course in their entire educational career.
Right.
And yet more than 50% are going to work in sales. The point is it's on-the-job learning out of necessity. Yep. And this says something about what you do with people after you hire them. And it's important to understand how salespeople learn. And this, I think, points to why a lot of money in sales training is wasted. But sales learning is a classic example of what the theorists in this area call modeling behavior,
mm-hmm,
right? And we know this. We know the research.
Right.
Research says you go to the training seminar, the rep forgets almost everything or at least 90% of what they learned within 90 days, one quarter. The way they learn is two ways. A, modeling behavior.
Yep.
They look, the motivated ones at least, look at what the best of their peers are doing. And they say, you know, that's clever. I hadn't thought about that way of dealing with that objection or that way of framing the value proposition, et cetera. And then the other learning that's important, especially in sales, is just-in-time learning. In other words, getting me the information that I need when I need it,
mm-hmm,
not weeks or months earlier in a training seminar. And here the technology is the seller's friend. There's more and more technology available, some of which I talk about in the book, but more and more technology available that allows companies to provide that information when reps will actually use it on their way to a sales call or sometimes literally during the sales conversation.
Yeah, well, I mean, so RingDNA, the company that owns this podcast, is introduced a product called Yoda AI, which is, in context, when you're on a call, you're a seller, somebody asks you a question and the system is listening, it hears the key words that might, let's say they ask about a competitor, it'll say, hey, here's a battle card for you on that competitor. It'll pop up on your screen. Click here to download it. Yeah. That's happening. Yeah, that's out there now.
Yeah, and by the way, I'd forgotten. I hadn't realized that, Ring is our godfather here, but I'm not shy about this. You'll see in the book, I use some of their data. And the data, I think that they have about what information is relevant when you're calling at level A versus level B is very, very illuminating. And that's exactly the kinds of things that that reps need. Having a C-level conversation, one of the perennial issues in sales, is qualitatively different than talking about product and specs with the gatekeepers to the C-level. Yeah.
Well, and that's exactly right. And that's where that type of system can help in terms of being that, omnipresent digital sales assistant to help. Well, I want to get back to the hiring part because, you sort of talk a little bit about a process in there, and I think this is such a big thing because companies, as I said, are just all over the board, and I have examples of companies I've talked to, for instance, that from an interviewing standpoint is if. Companies love to bring people's candidates in and talk to multiple people. But when they do that now, these organizations, they have, everybody that talks to that person, with the exception, I guess, maybe the hiring manager, asks the same questions in the same order. And so they then have the ability to get together afterwards. And when they debrief, they say they can compare how this person answered this question. What do you think of that? And so they have a common context.
Yep.
And I was just wondering if you have other things that you've seen that companies are doing that sort of help standardize the process or give more data points that they can then also look at maybe even retrospectively to improve the quality of hiring decisions they're making.
Yeah. And well, I think you've pointed to one simple but very, very important and fundamental one. And that is precisely because we know that the individual interview has very, very low predictive power. We also know the power of first impressions.
Yes. Right?
The single most important thing you can do is make sure that you get multiple inputs, multiple independent separate inputs about the candidate. And that's exactly what you're pointing to. And what you're pointing out is that, listen, we then can compare if we have some kind of standard protocol. We then can compare how so-and-so answered your question, what you thought, what you interpreted, and me. So that's very important. You're going to laugh at this, but there's an exercise that I use in my MBA class, have done for the last few years, and it's a sales hiring exercise. The students, and I literally bring in salespeople for them to interview. Mm-hmm. They get their LinkedIn pages beforehand, so they've got this information about them. And they've got to hire them for, they're interviewing people for two positions in two different companies that earlier in the course we discussed in case studies. So they know something about the company, their strategy, the buying process, the tasks, et cetera. They go through this and then we debrief, right? They literally interview these people in the room this year via Zoom. And then we debrief with both the interviewees, the salespeople that they interviewed, and the students. And when I ask the students, what did you think? The first thing they always say is, wow, people who sell for a living are really good at interviews. Huh? Who knew?
Right? Who knew, right?
Yeah, I mean, of course. But that's learning. You're not hiring the interview version of the person. You're looking to hire for behavior. And then the second thing that they always say, and I think this is relevant to managers, I always ask the students beforehand what they've got to hand in. This is, you know, the preparation for the exercise. Here's what you're hiring for. Here's a person you've been assigned to interview. Tell me what it is you're looking to find out. And always, when you total up the responses, and I show this to the students, always near the top of the list is something about their cultural fit or their, you know, their quote motivation. And then down near the bottom of the list are things like their communication skills or experience. And what they learn when we do the debrief is that they're, I'm going to use a wonderful American phrase, Andy, they get it exactly bass-ackwards, as do most managers. What you can learn in an interview is somebody's communication skills, right? Are they mumblers? Are they not mumblers? Experience, that's what a resume is about, and you can explore that. What is very difficult, if not impossible, to learn are the things at the top of their list, right? Their motivation, et cetera. And many managers, I think, simply commit the same mistakes that these relatively inexperienced MBA students do, but at least they learn from it.
or maybe not, because I don't know, my impression over the years, not just my experience, but hiring people, but other people, is that, they tend to make the same mistakes.
Well, you know, the old definition of insanity,
right?
Doing the same thing over and over and expecting a different result.
Well, I want to cover two things in the time we have left real quickly. One is I thought really interesting is, there's a lot of reliance in some companies on personality assessments. And, I think, maybe nothing wrong with them as a data point, but I know companies that sort of swear by them as sort of a qualifier or disqualifier. And you wrote that the research behind these is not substantial, that I think there's a quote here from the book is research does not has not shown that personality traits, I didn't type it correctly, basically saying that personality tests don't correlate with selling performance.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And yet there's still almost seems like an increasing reliance on these. I'm just wondering, in your opinion, what's the right place to use these or the right purpose to use a personality assessment?
Well, I mean, first you got to know what these assessments are and are not good for, what they were designed to do. Then you got to understand how to use them as opposed to misuse them. And then thirdly, you ask yourself the question, why am I doing this? I mean, most of the personality assessments in my experience, Myers-Briggs would be a great example.
Right. Or DISC.
Yeah. They were never developed for hiring purposes. They simply weren't developed for that reason. That's not the diagnostics that they're aiming at. Secondly, with some of them, Myers-Briggs, a good example, the diagnostics themselves are very, very debatable. As a number of people have pointed out,
sure.
You can almost answer any of those questions different ways. And in fact, what the social scientists call the replicability test, Myers-Briggs and many of these other assessments fail that test. You give the same test to the same person 3, 6, 9 months later, they come out very differently. So, there's A, was what it was designed for. B, do I have a valid assessment, even if I'm using it for what it was designed for? And then we come to the managerial issue. Most managers, in my experience, are literally untrained in how to interpret the results they do get from the assessments. So, I think if you're going to use the, if you're going to swear by these assessments, that's a big, big mistake. Now, I think companies, some companies swear by them in an attempt to avoid two other things. One is all the biases that I talked about earlier about simply doing unstructured interviews.
Right.
And thirdly, in certain businesses, you do have regulatory issues. So you can say we're not guilty of some other kind of bias because everybody had to do this test, see what the result is. But what its actual behavioral impact is, I'm afraid, is not that simply not that compelling.
Right. Yeah, I've always been uncomfortable with tests that claim that, hey, on the basis of this test, we can tell whether this person has what it takes to be good in sales.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I've just personally have seen so many people across such a broad spectrum of personality types succeed, and succeed well, that, yeah, just for me, it's like, okay, it's an interesting data point, but not deterministic.
No, and that's relevant to, you know, the other research in the book that you quite rightly pointed to. And again, this is like a century's worth of research. The correlation between different personality attributes and selling effectiveness is all over the place. You'll find studies that talk about, personality attribute A correlates very highly with sales success. You try to replicate the study, and it's very different. One of the reasons, again, is because sales is so context specific.
Yep.
The example I always point to is, how many companies do you know that hired the guy or gal who was an absolute superstar in sales at company A, and somehow they lose it? They're not good at our company or the startup, right? The early stage venture where the VCs say, boy, I can get you this star from Oracle and bring him in. Why is that the case? Those people didn't suddenly get stupid, when they left that company. It's not like they lost their individual capabilities, but so much of selling in particular depends on the context, depends on who else you're working with in your company. Your ability to develop those relationships, those people have to recreate all of that when they move from company A to company B. So, the assessments are only going to get you just so far in making that judgment as well.
Well, but I think this is you sort of grabbed the last point I wanted to bring up, because this has been a pet peeve of mine for a long time. Is in the old days, it used to be called hiring a Rolodex, right?
Yeah.
I almost never saw it work out. It doesn't translate. Yeah, I remember in the early days of tech, some of the companies like Apple, where I worked, and others were expanding, and they were hiring people from big companies to come in. And quite frankly, many of them struggled for the reasons you spoke about, is that they didn't have the infrastructure around them that they're accustomed to. And it didn't mean they were bad people or they weren't good in other environments, but there are, horses for courses. And you talk about this as well, as hiring the right person at the right time, this temporal dimension of hiring. They're just not a fit for what you have. And this is hard for people to think. They think that just sheer talent will always win out, and it doesn't.
Yeah. I mean, first, I agree with everything you just said. The only thing I would add, the only caveat I would add, Andy, is, again, let me get back to what I think is the fundamental issue facing a lot of sales managers. Making sure that because we understand how buying happens at our target accounts today, not yesterday, we understand the key sales tasks. I think you can occasionally buy the Rolodex. If, in fact, what you're asking for is for that person simply to open the door. Mm. But then you've got to ask yourself the relative ROI question. Is it worth the money I'm paying? Or are there other ways I can open this door besides hiring this person, whether it's better lead gen processes or a channel partner, et cetera.
Right.
So, occasionally the Rolodex can in fact pay off, but usually because the what I'll call the buying company knows what it is they want and what it is they don't want. And if we get with the person can actually sell for us as well, hey, that's a bonus. That's been my experience.
Yeah. And I didn't mean to say blanket that doesn't work, but it's to your point, that's my experience substantiated what you had written in the book is it's, you know, stop. And also, hiring people from the outside and giving them sort of, you know, key accounts and so on for those who are being brought up throughout the organization, that's a huge demotivator. Yeah, I've seen that as well in companies where, you know, they want to grow, they want to get into a certain type of accounts or so on and so forth. And it's always, well, hey, let's go hire the hired guns to do that. And you end up getting, you know, people that are in process in their career developing, moving up in terms of the type of accounts they can handle, and they'll leave.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think, you know, whatever else you do, you got to grow your own, as we used to say about cannabis. And then I think you can add on to that if indeed you really know what it is you're looking for.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree. Well, good. Well, Frank, we've run out of time for this session. We're definitely going to have you back to talk about the rest of the book. People want to grab the book. I presume it's on Amazon and so on.
Yes, it is. And it's called Sales Management That Works, How to Sell in a World That Never Stops Changing. And you can get bulk discounts from the publisher, Harvard Business Review Press, as well. But it's also available on Amazon, Goodreads, et cetera.
And if people want to connect with you, LinkedIn, I presume as well?
Yeah, I'm on LinkedIn as well. That's correct.
Perfect. All right. Well, Frank, thank you so much. And yeah, we're going to do this again very shortly.
Andy, my thanks to you. And I mean that sincerely. Thank you very much.
Okay, friends, that's it for this episode. First of all, I want to thank you for taking the time to listen. We're ever so grateful for your support of this program. And I want to thank my guest, Frank Cespedes, for sharing his insights with us today. If you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe to this podcast, Sales Enablement with Andy Paul, on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you could also leave us a rating or a review and let us know how we're doing, well, we'd appreciate that. You can do all that on your phone in less than a minute as soon as this episode is over. So thank you for your help. And as always, thank you so much for investing your time with me today. Until next time, I'm your host, Andy Paul. Good selling, everyone.
Hey, sales strategists. At Revenue.io, we're not just imagining the future of sales, we're building it. We offer the world's most complete platform for revenue teams, and we're featured in the most recent Forrester waves for both sales engagement and conversation intelligence. With Revenue.io, you can slash call prep time to seconds, guide your reps in real time to have more successful conversations, and after calls, we generate ready-to-send recap emails so sellers can keep deals soaring toward the finish line at light speed. See the future of sales now at Revenue.io.